Radiolab is supported by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and can be more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Visit betterhelp.com/radiolab today to get 10% off your first month.
Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about you and your money. You like to relax every now and then. Your money likes to work. And Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. While you're catching up on sleep, your money is up early, automatically reinvesting your dividends. Your money is a total workhorse, so you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab
from
WNYC.
And NPR.
So where are we?
We're in a church.
In a church? Oh, that's different for us.
It's not usually where we start. We're in a church.
Mm-hmm.
Cathedral, really. A huge cathedral in Upper Manhattan, St. John the Divine. We've got an organ.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the preacher. There's a preacher.
Congregation, of course.
Mm-hmm.
A couple thousand people in the pews, at least.
Jesus said, therefore I tell you.
Your basic Sunday service. Except today. You've also got, here it comes, dogs. The reason we begin here is because today the church is filled with dogs.
Can I talk to you about your dog?
Yeah.
What's his or her name?
His name is Blizzard.
And what is he?
He's a Labrador and Poodle mix.
Well, I have Legend, who I just adopted in January.
Okay.
I have Denzel.
Oh, by the way, you know, more than dogs, you've got birds.
His name is Jesse. It's a barn owl.
And now, has this guy ever been blessed before?
I don't think so, no. He was just born this year.
In hamsters?
His name is Tubby. Teddy Toes. And if he'd come out, you'd see why. It's because he's really fat.
And all kinds of creatures.
We've got a little girl with a falcon, and behind her, oh, it's a giant tortoise.
This is the St. Francis Day of the Animals. It's a yearly event.
Right, and coming toward us,
where people bring their animals to be blessed.
Is a donkey.
The folks that are gathered here.
And there's a little girl with a hermit crab.
They don't think there's anything weird or inappropriate about this. In fact, if you ask them.
And here comes a bull.
Here's what they say.
I don't know if it means anything to her, but it means it to me. Because,
yeah,
you know, you want to baptize your babies, and
yeah,
this is more or less the same kind of thing.
And what is it? What does it mean to you?
It just means when she finally does go away, she's going to go to heaven.
And what kind of parrot is she?
Call blue and gold. Oh, yeah, don't put your hand near his face.
And what's his name?
Chuckles.
Chuckles. Do you feel like he has a soul or an inner life of some sort?
It's a thinking being. They're as smart as we are, really. And
Jack?
Yeah.
Since you invited me here, I don't want to be impolite or anything.
Say what you got to say.
Well, okay. These people, of course, they love their animal.
Sure, yeah, you can hear that.
Because when I'm feeling sad, he comes in the bed and he lays down spine to spine with me, and he just doesn't leave my side.
But aren't they presuming a little bit that the animals they love are going to feel the grace of the prayer or feel the blessing, which is a...
Well, which raises a question.
What do we really know about what goes on inside the animal's mind?
Yeah. All those things that you might feel in a church, grace, gratitude, guilt. Can the animals feel those things too?
How much can we share?
And can you measure it?
Yeah.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And we'll begin the hour with a story about an animal who would, I'm sure, love to have been at the worship service, but it was a very inconvenient thing.
It didn't get the invite.
Couldn't quite get there.
in cages to get things rolling. This is a story that we heard about.
It's okay, I give him enough to talk about.
First, from the following dude.
Hey, is it Mick or is it Mike?
I go by Mick. There's way too many mics around.
Okay.
Mick Menigo is his name. And we met Mick recently at the Emeryville Marina, which is not far from San Francisco, where he's got a boat called the Superfish. That Mick says he rents out for all kinds of things.
Nature trips to ash gathering, bachelor parties, fireworks watching, I don't care. I got a little cardboard sign. I stand by the freeway. It says, have boat need work.
So yeah, that's Mick. And our story begins one morning in December.
Probably 8 o'clock in the morning or something, as I recall.
A few years back. Mick was just kind of sitting at home.
I was at home, yeah. It was the middle of December. We didn't have any work.
But then he gets this call.
Hello?
Got this call.
Hello there.
It was a call relaying a message from a fisherman way out at sea.
18 miles, maybe, outside the Golden Gate Bridge. They told me that there was a whale in trouble, tangled up in crab gear, and it didn't appear to be able to move.
So after he hangs up, Mick immediately calls a few dive buddies.
Tim Young,
Air Force Pararescue.
And then, let's see.
James Mosquito. Professional diver.
I called him and said, hey, you know, here's the deal. Are you interested?
It was a no-brainer.
I said, yeah, I'm in.
Absolutely.
Figured, all right, we're going.
So I packed up my stuff.
Grabbed my gear and I went directly to the boat.
And we left underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. Nothing but the horizon in front of us. My name is Holly Druyard. I am James's significant other. We motored out for about 2 hours. Headed due west towards the Farallon Islands.
What were you feeling when you were on the boat heading out?
I didn't think we'd find her. I really didn't.
But about 18 miles off the coast, completely open water, one of the divers spots some crab buoys in the distance and some seagulls flying overhead. And as they got closer...
Well, I saw the whale.
It was just...
Just the very top of the whale.
Sticking up about maybe 6 inches out of the water.
At the surface.
A tiny sliver of black.
And that was it. I said, okay, we need to see what's going on. So
Tim and James jump into an inflatable boat, and they paddle about a couple hundred feet from the whale.
And it just wasn't happening. Every time that this whale came on up, it would just displace the boat back again. So it would push us back again.
Not to mention...
The visibility in the water was just terrible.
They couldn't even see down there to see, you know, what they were dealing with.
And you know what? Sometimes plans have to change in mid-flight.
So Tim and James look at each other, and without saying a word...
Boom. We got out of the boat and...
Splashed into the water.
And I see a shadow. This massive animal.
A hazy silhouette.
And we just started swimming.
To the whale. About 100 feet away.
You know, parts of a blubber and skin floating around.
35 feet. 20 feet.
And then they see it.
My goodness, this thing's the size of a school bus.
A female humpback whale is one of the largest creatures on the planet. 50 feet long, 50 tons. And this particular whale was in a kind of C shape, where its head was at the top of the water, but its tail was almost pointed directly down.
It was almost like somebody was pulling her down by the tail to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, there was probably 20 crab traps, 2,000 pounds at least, just tied up to the tail.
She had just become an anchor.
An anchored.
And to see her not be able to move that tail and to struggle.
Just like... The whale was actually really laboring to breathe. It's a little puff. And there's just rope everywhere. It went around the whale's mouth, around the whale's head.
Across her eye, over her back.
Wrapped around the pectoral fins, all the way down to his tail. I thought there was no hope.
There's no chance.
We're looking at a dead whale. The whale just doesn't know it yet. But I knew that I had to try. I'm going to swim to the whale. And as soon as I decided, okay, I'm going to swim to the whale, well, the whale decided she wasn't going to have that.
What'd she do?
She put up her pectoral fin, which is like her arm. And this pectoral fin's about 15 feet long. It's about 4 feet wide. And she just splashed down the water in front of me. You know, it's the size of an airplane wing coming down on top of you. Just inches from my head. So at that point, I backed off and waited.
waited for the whale to settle down.
She was physically exhausted.
Which she did. And then they both swim back. James goes to the tail, and Tim up to the whale's head.
You know, I was there with a 6-inch dive knife.
Cutting out line right near her eye.
Which was the size of a grapefruit. And her eye was moving. Keeping an eye on me.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
He would go left, her eye would go left. He'd go right, her eye would go right.
She was tracking me.
And all the while, they're just cutting as much rope as they can.
You really had a saw at it. It was very strong, very tight. Sometimes I'd cut a rope, and it would be a loose rope, and all of a sudden something else would tighten up. Which was the one rope that would let it all free.
This whole process took hours. But finally, James gets to the end of it. He's at the tail, sawing his way through that big clump of line, and he realizes at a certain point that to cut through all that line...
I'm going to have to stab the whale to get my knife underneath the rope. It was that tight, though. I jabbed my knife into the whale's tail and pulled the rope and then cut it.
And at once, the rope went...
It was a very surreal moment, looking down and seeing the 20 crab traps and buoys just disappear into the abyss.
And just like that, the whale was gone.
I'm spinning around going, where'd she go, where'd she go?
But as the water settled, they realized they'd done it. They'd freed her.
As soon as I came up, I was like, woohoo, wow, hooping it up and yelling. And unbelievable.
I was screaming. Can you imagine?
Now here's where the story takes a pretty startling turn. In fact, the whole reason we wanted to tell this story to begin with is for what happens next. So Tim and James and the other divers are in the water. They're celebrating, high-fiving. And then all of a sudden, James looks down.
Next thing I know, I have this 50-ton whale coming right at me. I'm thinking, oh my God, stop, I just saved you.
Wait, so this whale is coming at you from below, like Jaws?
Yeah, she's rising up towards me.
Oh God.
And I'm just thinking, this is going to hurt. And when she was only inches away from my chest, she stopped. And pushed me on the chest backwards. And then released me and then kind of pushed again. And then released and pushed again. And again.
Wow.
And then she swam up right next to me, picks her head up above the water so that her eye was above the water. And then came up and looked directly at me.
And for what felt like 30 seconds, he says, she just... stared at him.
The pupil didn't move around. She wasn't looking for anything else. She was just looking at me. You're in the presence of something that great. Makes you feel small.
Yeah.
It really was a very emotional feeling. You know, I wasn't quite sure what to make of it.
But then he says... she went off to the next diver.
Did the same thing.
I remember distinctly, I was 18 inches away from her eye, and she just looked at me and let me touch her, and then swam off.
Then she went off to the next diver and did the same thing, and the next person and did the same thing.
One by one.
Coming up right next to him, looking at him really good, you know, inches away, eyeballing him.
She swam around to every diver.
All the guys got it.
So it was about dusk. The water was glass flat. I was sitting at the helm of the boat, just... in awe. And they had to leave the whale. She didn't want to leave them.
Now, there's a real question here. What exactly was that whale doing? Or saying? Was she saying anything? If you ask James or Tim or Mick or any of the other divers that were in the water that day, they'll tell you.
I felt this whale was really thanking us.
I know it sounds crazy, but I could see the look in her eye. This mammal, this 50-ton mammal, was literally saying thanks. Thanks for helping me out. And, you know, I'll bring that to my grave, knowing the gratification that I felt.
here's the question, really. Was that whale saying thank you?
Was the whale saying... Well, I think the whale was saying something. I mean, a whale, if she was just free of her ropes, I would think she would just go off and say, woof, I'm free. So the fact that she was...
That she hung around...
And make these circled, specific
eyeball
visits, like, I don't know, I feel that she... There's something intentional about that. She didn't leave anyone out, right?
No, she went, in fact, according to one of the guys on the boat, she actually went to the boats and did the same thing to the boats.
She said thank you to the boats?
Yeah.
Well, then. So she was looking at the people, but she also thought that the craft was something she had to say thank you or say deal with.
Yeah.
So maybe she was just sight. Maybe she was just, I really don't know what. She, I mean, I don't feel completely comfortable just saying, of course, I know what I want to feel.
Yeah, me too.
But let's just try to straighten up for a second. We have a guy named Clive Wynn who teaches at the university.
Hello.
Hey.
Oh, hi. Is this Mr. Clive Wynn?
Yeah, this is Clive Wynn.
Hi. Ah.
Clive is with the psychology department at the University of Florida.
Who am I talking? Who's this?
This is Jad from Radio 11.
Right. Robert. Hi, Jad.
Clive also happens to be an expert on animal psychology.
Hi, and this is Robert also.
Hi, Robert.
Can you hear us pretty well?
I can hear you pretty well. I'm wondering how well I'm going to distinguish your voices.
Oh.
No need to do that.
Treat us as a unitary figure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Listen, let me begin. This is Robert talking. Mm-hmm. We'll tell you a story, and we want to know what you think of the story.
So once upon a time, and not too long ago...
All right, we're going to fast forward a bit. Because we ran Clive through the entire whale story, front to back.
So my question to you is...
If a diver said to you, this whale said thank you to me, what would you say?
Well, I would be put in a difficult situation because I don't doubt that what these people experienced was a very moving moment with that whale. But the problem is, I just don't speak whale. So I don't know what thank you looks like in whale. If I'm going to be a cynic about it, I would say, well, the whale has been trapped for, I believe, over a day and may just be disoriented.
Well, but this was parking herself with one individual and then moving to the next. That's not a distracted. That looks like it's got some intention.
It shows some interest in the individuals. I'll give you that. But how do we get from that to deducing that the whale is trying to express thanks?
What do you mean?
Let's play a different example. Let's suppose that you found a bear in the woods that was caught up in some netting that ended up in the woods, and you work for hours to free the bear. And then the bear eats you. Does that mean that the bears are an ungrateful species of animal?
Yes. No, I don't truly believe that.
Right. Yes. Well, so I mean, it would make as much sense to ascribe ingratitude to the bear as it does to ascribe gratitude to the whale. I just don't think that's a useful way of trying to understand animals. And I think it demeans them because it means that instead of living in a world that's full of a diversity of wonderful creatures, each with its own ways of relating to other members of its own species and other members of other species, we say, well, we don't live in a world like that. We live in a world that's basically a world of human beings. It doesn't matter. Some of these human beings have fur suits on. Some of these human beings weigh hundreds of tons and live under the ocean and can hold their breath for a very long time. None of that really matters. Ultimately, they're all basically like us. And I just don't find that satisfying.
Mm. Are you saying that you don't know if there's a possibility of sharing or that you don't think that there's a possibility of sharing at an emotional level between two species?
I don't doubt that there is the possibility of sharing between two species. I mean, I see it with dogs all the time. But I think it would be a mistake if we thought that the love we feel for our dogs is the same feeling that the dog has back to us. It has different qualities.
You pet your dog and it wags its tail and it seems happy to see you.
Yeah.
Do you just like not trust that?
Well, okay. So let me make clear that I wear two hats. When I'm talking about a dog, particularly a pet of my own, I have two possible hats I can wear. And one is that when the dog pants back at me, I just hug the dog and, you know, let him kiss me. And that's life with a dog. But if I'm now wearing my scientific hat and getting my blanket as wet as I possibly can, then I ask myself, what do these behaviors mean among dogs? There's a beautiful study that came out recently from Alexandra Horowitz.
I'm Alexandra Horowitz. And I study dog cognition.
Where do we find her?
She's around the corner from you. She's at Barnard College.
So we sent our producer, Soren Wheeler.
Yo, that's me.
To meet her. And he ended up hanging out with her and her dog, Finnegan.
Yeah.
In the park.
Oh, good snuffle. That's a nice snuffle. Do you want to snuffle with the mic?
She did this beautiful experiment that shows that when people think their dog is looking guilty,
ears back, eyes lowered, tail between the legs,
actually the dog is just being submissive.
So here's what she did. She tracked down a bunch of dog owners.
Posted on Craigslist and put out posters.
And she found a bunch of owners who believe that, like most dog owners do, that their dogs feel guilt.
Yes, my dog feels guilty when he's done something wrong.
And then she set up a situation where all of the dog owners had to scold their dogs because, you know, they had been told that their dogs did something bad. But the trick of the experiment is that only half the dogs had done something wrong.
Half the dogs had actually been naughty, and half the dogs had not been naughty. But then she
misinformed the owners.
Lied to half of the owners.
So we lied to the owners.
So even the owners whose dogs hadn't been bad thought their dogs had been bad. So everybody scolded their dog.
And almost everyone did this the same way, which was to say no loudly to their dogs and maybe put their hands on their hip and express disapproval.
No.
Yes.
Finnegan.
I can't
believe you ate.
Finnegan. Oh, Criddle. It's okay.
See, Finnegan just made the look, even though he hadn't done anything wrong. And that's essentially what she found. Even the non-guilty dogs made the guilty look.
It didn't matter whether the dog had transgressed or not. All that mattered was whether it was being chastised by its owner.
So bad dog.
Right.
That creates the look, not the deed.
That's exactly right.
But for me, the pivotal question here is not whether or not they all had the look, but what's attached to that look? What feeling in the dog is attached to that guilty look? Maybe the dogs who were falsely accused still felt bad.
Well, maybe they did. Maybe they did. And maybe there are angels on top of this control console here.
I thought it was a perfectly valid question. Anyhow, we should thank Alexandra Horowitz. Her latest book is called Inside of a Dog.
And before we end this section, have we resolved the question of what was that whale doing with those people? Was she saying thank you or no?
No. And do we ever resolve any questions at all?
Well, we try. We get a little closer than we got in this fifth section.
No, we have not resolved.
So
but
we will try harder?
But in our next section, a mere 70 seconds away, we will try very hard to actually get scientific about it.
Good.
Hi, this is Tim Young out in California on my first take of reading the Radiolab credits. So here goes. Radiolab is funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation and the National Science Foundation.
Hi, this is Clive Wynne. Radiolab is produced by WMYC and distributed by NPR.